afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you are listening to Financial Survival. The second and third segment today, I am pleased to have my conversation with James Corbett. Make sure you visit his website, thecorbettreport.com. It was previously recorded, and it's an excellent program. We didn't talk too much about finances, but what we did talk is truly about the elite and the agenda and, you know, where the world really is heading in the near future and the signs that no one talks about. And it's a very interesting program, so an interview, discussion, conversation, whatever you might call it. So I'm always so pleased to have my time with James Corbett. So please make sure you stay tuned. And it is Friday, February 22nd, 2019. Well, we had a great day for gold and silver today, just to let you know, if you're looking in the last 6 months, we had gold has soared 14%, 14% for gold. So we are looking at gold today. It's off the high of the day. We had a high of 1333. We're now at 1328. Up $4.80. Silver had a high, 1605. We are currently at 1599, up 13 cents. Platinum had a big day, up 2.3%, up $19.846. And in the New York spot price aftermarket, palladium was up $24, touching $1,500. So, but platinum was the metal of the day, up 2.3%. The USDX today was down 0.06 at 96.55. Crude oil was up 0.23 at 57.19. And we're going to talk about why seems like the stock market had pretty good jump today. Let me get to that market. You have the Dow up 181 points. It did cross over 26,000, 26,032. The NASDAQ was up 67 at 7,527. And the S&P was up 17 at 2,792. 10-year yield was down 0.03, 2.66%. It looks like Berkshire Hathaway, Warren Buffett is having a bad day. Kraft Heinz, they plunged, I saw earlier today, 25%. That was about, I don't know how many billions of dollars for maybe that he lost. So $4 billion is $4 billion. It doesn't matter how many you have at the bank or you gave away to Microsoft. $4 billion is still $4 billion. So we're going to talk. First, I want to make an announcement. This announcement came from the U.S. Mint. It was released late yesterday, so I didn't have a chance to share with you on the program at 4 o'clock Eastern Time. And so I want to update you on the U.S. Mint. They have sold out of the 2018 and 2019 American Silver Eagles. Again, the Mint issued this statement late yesterday, Thursday, telling us that they had run out of last year's and this year's dated 1 ounce coins, Silver Eagles. Market fluctuations have resulted in a temporary sellout of the 2018 and 2019 silver bullion. Production at the Mint's West Point facility continues, and when sales resume in a few weeks, silver bullion will be offered under allocation. Year to date, the U.S. Mint has sold more than 6 million coins, the best start since 2017, which really wouldn't be hard to do. 2017 really had a bad start, so it wouldn't be too hard to brag about that. But it is exciting, and this surge in sales comes with it was a bad 2018. So this really is a good sign. People are waking up. I do believe they see the problems that we face. They understand and see that silver is certainly valued and it has the potential to do some great percentage gains. So, but 2018 actually saw the lowest coin sales in 11 years. With this, though, comes a rise on the premium. You're looking for boxes of 500. If you buy the Green Monster box, you're paying almost $3 over spot. So they raised they raised it, what, 60 cents? So it's the premiums with the mint and the wholesalers, it's about 60 cent premium. That my premium's the same. I didn't raise mine. It's still the same. But when they raise my cost, I do have to pass that on to you. That's the way the real world works. So if you're looking to buy volume of silver, the next best item would be perhaps to buy the Canadian maple leaf. You're only paying 2.25 to 2.50 over spot, so you're not saving, you're saving 75 cents to 50 cents. So, not a significant savings, but if you're buying volume, yes, it does turn into a significant savings. The U.S. Mint, they've been selling the Silver Eagles on a first-come, first-served basis, and every time they do this, they do run out of product. Maybe we can blame the government shutdown, as there wasn't anyone there to see the inventory shrinking, and maybe suggest to management and say, gee, maybe we should produce some product and begin the allocation program again. Now, this is me talking, but with that said, again, this is another sign that you shouldn't wait. We wait, we think we have all the time in the world. Gold and silver products, it's going to disappear so fast. When we wake up that one day to a brand new world, the product is going to disappear so fast, it's going to make your head spin. We get lulled into thinking we have all the time in the world. But one day, all that time in the world is going to be gone. We're going to wake up to a brand new world, and then everyone is going to scramble to try to get everything in order. And there won't be anything gold and silver available to get your items in order. So it's, I do believe we have some tough times coming. There's more and more reports. Jimmy Rogers, I think most of you listeners know who Jimmy Rogers is. He gets interviewed all the time. And, he's a multimillionaire. I don't think he's quite up there in the billionaire like his ex-partner Soros was. But, he lives over in Vietnam. And, he's really spot on. He does talk about the debt. He talks about the next world recession. And it's going to be the worst thing that he's ever seen anywhere at any time. And he's been around, ladies and gentlemen. So don't wait. Give us a call, 800-375-4188. The United States and China, they are discussing a late March meeting between President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping in Florida, Mar-a-Lago. Sources also confirmed to CNBC that China was committed to buying up to $1.2 trillion in U.S. goods. Once that was released again this afternoon, the markets did bump up, went over 26,000. This isn't the first time this has been released. It was a little over a month ago. They came out and said that China was committed to buying over $1 trillion worth. Even a year ago, when all of these meetings really first started getting together, China was committed to additional purchases of U.S. goods and so forth. So it's been in the news, and it goes behind the news. And then when they want the markets to move, they'll bring this out to show us that things are going along and things are just great. So, but again, they are committing to $1 trillion. But the big question is, maybe China just might sell some of that debt to purchase this additional $1.2 trillion. Their economy's not that good. I heard it was mainly in agriculture and energy, which is oil. Not sure how that's all going to trickle down to everyone across the country. I'm not sure how that's going to help in manufacturing. I mean, considering China is the largest manufacturer of products in the world, so I'm not sure how we can get some of that back here. These are just my questions. So I'm not sure how any of this is going to do anything for our current account deficit. We have to become fiscally responsible. I believe we're beyond becoming fiscally responsible, but at least Congress could act like it or show that they have some concerns or pretend that they're looking for some, or that they are still the fiscally responsible party. So we may have to reduce our trade deficit with China, but our trade deficit with someone else might just increase as a consequence. So we're looking at China increasing goods by 200 billion per year for one, about 200 billion. I'm not sure if that's the exact number, but for 1.2 trillion in 6 years. So it's we'll have to see how these negotiations go, but our problem is still our debt. And so it's good news for the trade discussions, and we'll see how it affects gold and silver. One of my pet peeves is corporate buybacks. And judging by the early count in the first quarter, share buybacks, it seems to be on their way to another record year. We know that during 2018, companies had announced repurchases totaling over $1 trillion. And the buyback trend, starting first quarter earnings seasons, it's been striking. Bank of America, Merrill Lynch estimates repurchases are up 91% year over year, with staples and materials leading, followed by tech and financials. The past week, we saw nearly $2.8 billion, the fourth highest level since Bank of America began tracking the data point in 2009. Does anybody think that this is a coincidence? We've seen the markets rise after the Great Recession and to the point that the B of A, the Bank of America, began tracking the data to see the impacts, the amount of money, the billions of dollars being funneled to Wall Street to buy back their shares, to keep the markets propped up, to keep the system from collapsing. The current pace of buybacks would suggest a record year, plus financials and utilities, industrials, discretionary buybacks, while below post-2009 records are also set to eclipse last year's levels. You know, Wall Street has come to depend on these buybacks. You know, we're in this 10-year-old bull market. What comes next? Investors took out about $232 billion out of mutual and exchange-traded equity funds over the past 3 years. $232 billion. That's what they took out. But you had companies that have pumped in $1.8 trillion through repurchases. And you want to know why the stock market, the Dow, is at 26,000? Where are the fundamentals? What's going to hold it there? What happens when, you know, and that's another reason they had to drop rates. These corporations, these multinational corporations, they can't service their debt either. They can't roll over their debt with higher rates. They can't pay for it. It's just, and it's amazing. No one talks about this. No one talks about the day of reckoning. We're just all supposed to go along thinking that the economy is Wall Street and the Dow, the Nasdaq, and the S&P. Even though we had the worst December since the Great Depression, and we had the stock buybacks in the first part of this year so far up 91% year over year, it doesn't mean anything. Everybody thinks, oh, phew. I'm glad I didn't pull my money out back in December because the stock market always comes back. I'm relieved. The 40 grand that I lost in December, I got it back. It's, you know, if it wasn't going to hurt so many people, and if it would only hurt the people that created the problem, it'd be kind of funny. But the people who created the problem are only getting wealthy and wealthier by the problem because they know you, the taxpayer, will always be there. They know you have savings. They know what you have. They know where it's at. If you think that you're going to walk away from it, and I don't mean to, it's so many people, so many, and they're going to be in. So many people are going to be in a position and they won't be able to do anything about it. One thing we have, delinquent U.S. student loans, They reached a record $166 billion in the fourth quarter. Delinquent U.S. student loans reached a record $166 billion in fourth quarter. But it's also being reported that the delinquency rates for student loans are likely to be understated by half. And this is according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The figure is probably a far cry from reality, but we don't live in a world of reality anyway, so what difference does it make, right? Factoring for understatement would imply that about $333 billion in student debt has not been serviced in at least 3 months. Putting it into perspective, remember the troubled asset relief during the Great Recession? $441 billion was dispersed under the entire troubled asset relief. This doesn't include all the other quantitative easing programs and so forth. So that kind of puts it into a little bit of perspective. And, you know, the rise in these delinquencies from 2012 to 2018 is amazing. And we look at that period of time when we think our economy is supposedly rising and we're in the best economy in history, so we're told. So these kids, why? No one is discussing why. It's all, oh, it's so much. They're in debt. They can't pay for it. Why can't they get jobs to pay for it? No one discusses the real problem. Only that these delinquencies are there. And that these student loans, you know, give them free college so we don't have to worry about bad loans. The rise in automobile debt since the Great Recession. Listen to these numbers. Of all auto loans issued in the first two quarters of 2017, 42% carried a term of 6 years or longer. In 2009, it was 26%. So as the economy is taking off in 2017 and 2018, people need six years to pay off an automobile or longer compared to 2009 when we were in the Great Recession. Of course, maybe those seven-year loans were created. They came out of the Great Recession. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Give us a call, ladies and gentlemen. We got lots of product. We have a few Silver Eagles left, but we do have to charge the higher price for those, and certainly gold. And I had wanted to touch on about the synchronized economies. Doug Nolan had a great little article about this, about how the world economies are synchronized with stimulus. So again, listen, stay tuned. James Corbett will be joining you right after this brief break.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and yes, I am pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And of course, you know James is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, which was founded in 2007, and in 2012, James became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster. And of course, we know the International Forecaster was created by Robert Chapman. And you can visit both James' website at thecorbettreport.com and theinternationalforecaster.com. You can request a complimentary issue of the International Forecaster. And good evening, or good afternoon,
or good morning, or something. I don't know. Somewhere in the world. Good day to you. it's a pleasure to be here, as always. And you just reminded me that I'm going into my 7th calendar year of being the lead editorial writer for the Forecaster, which is incredible. The time flies. It was a blink of an eye.
It truly is. It truly is amazing how fast that time has gone by. Well, congratulations, and you do a terrific job. The International Forecaster is a great newsletter, and of course, so is your website. Before we get to an article that you recently published, I wanted to ask you. There's lots of rumors being circulated, and I'm not sure about the Basel III Accord. And there's a lot of information as far as the various tiers, and that gold is going to, and it does go into effect March 31st, I believe, of this year, even though the Basel III was done in 2012, I believe. They finally are bringing it up and passing and going into effect. But there's been a lot of discussions about how the rules are being changed in respect to gold and how it's being treated as a riskless asset. And there's all kinds of rumors floating around about, of course, gold and gold standards and everything else that usually is attached to gold. Are you aware of this information, and can you bring us your thoughts on it?
No, I am not, and no, I cannot, but ask me again in 2 weeks, because this is absolutely something that I'll be probably writing between now and there for the Forecaster. I remember the Basel III, the negotiations, and then when it was going to be introduced, and I was under the impression it had been introduced, but you're right, looking it up, it's the implementation deadline is now 31st of March 2019, so you're right, there are going to be some changes coming in the near future. What will that mean? Well, I'm going to have some homework now for me to do between now and the next time we talk.
Okay, I'm going to have my questions all ready for you in 2 weeks, James. So.
All right. Well, we'll both be prepared.
Okay. Your most recent article on thecorbettreport.com called Why Technocrats Love the Green New Deal. You talk about this new plan being rolled out recently by the new Congresswoman Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, AOC for short, and other progressives, and it won't come to fruition in the way it's being sold. However, it does provide a window into our technocratic future. Can you explain technocracy to the listeners, and how does this so-called Green New Deal relate to it?
in 50 words or less. Let's talk about the Green New Deal first, because I'm sure at least everyone in the audience has probably heard of it by this point. They may not know the details of it, and join the club if you don't, because very few people do. That was kind of the opening to my article there, where I highlight a video that came out recently, one of those kind of man on the street interview videos where they go to a college campus and they ask people about, oh, what do you feel about Alexandria, Ocasio-Cortez, and what do you feel about the Green New Deal? Oh, it sounds good, you know, anything we can do to help the environment, blah, blah, blah. And then they start laying out some of the things that are actually in this Green New Deal plan, and everyone's like, that's unrealistic, I didn't know they were saying that, oh, that's silly. So it's one of those types of videos, which, hey, for whatever kind of editing and things they do to it, it still proves a point, which is no one really knows what this Green New Deal is about. Something that was actually admitted by no less a personage than Queen Pelosi herself, who said, the Green Dream, or whatever they call it, nobody knows what it is, but they're for it, right? That's a perfect quote, yeah. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. So this Green New Deal plan was kind of floating around in this nebulous, vague sort of, everyone kind of has an idea. Well, obviously, it's going to be about trying to re-gear the economy for the green economy and zero emissions or something. But it was just kind of floating around out there. So a few weeks ago, the AOC congressional website put up a FAQ, a frequently asked questions page, answering some people's questions about it, which immediately came under fire from several directions, one of which was that it contained some language saying that not only does the Green New Deal say that, you know, the provide economic security for all those in the economy who are unable to work, which, as I note in the article, is pretty standard fare in the modern nanny state era. That's kind of what we would expect from the cradle-to-grave nanny state government, right? And anyone who's unable to work will be taken care of by loving mommy government. But also all those who are unwilling to work. Unwilling to work? Really? Wait, that gives even the most diehard socialists a bit of pause for thought. Well, maybe that's not how we quite want to phrase that, right? So the AOC Congressional Committee Team Campaign Whatever website team immediately started to try to walk it back. Well, first they said, no, those screenshots that are being passed around right now from that page, which we immediately took down, those have been doctored by those evil right-wing websites. They eventually, the archive of that document on their site was found, so they can't really deny they posted it to their website. So then they started saying, no, that, you don't understand. That was just for internal use. That wasn't meant for public distribution. Is that supposed to make anything better?
Yeah, really.
But anyway, whatever. So they created quite a stir with that. But also some of the specifics in the plan. Eventually, as people might know, a few weeks ago, or a week or two ago now, they did actually table some draft legislation, proposed legislation, that I guess is part of this Green New Deal. I don't think it encompasses the Green New Deal, but they want everyone to focus on the legislation now, which has, even in and of itself, some crazy ideas in there that, as I say, probably won't come to fruition. Like, just as one example, that Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, and who may be the Democratic presidential candidate wildcard in the 2020 race, who knows, but he, who you would expect to be on the side of this Green New Deal, came out immediately to criticize it and say it was ridiculous, and pointing out it says, for example, that every building in the United States is going to have to be refitted, retrofitted, or rebuilt in order to meet these new green standards, which is impossible. It would be rebuilding or retrofitting 2,000 or 3,000 buildings per day, every day for the next 10 years. Not going to happen. Along with a number of other things. Every new job in the green economy is going to be unionized, and there's going to be a zero emission transportation infrastructure funding between now and then, and blah, blah, blah. A lot of things that, yeah, it might sound nice, but there's no way it's going to happen. And as I say, and that leads us to your question, as I say, though, that, yeah, this is not going to happen the way that it's being sold to the public. And I think we can all see it as kind of pie in the sky. Maybe you could imagine well-meaning socialism. I don't think it is. But anyway, you could imagine.
But it has a purpose. It has a purpose, though, right?
Exactly right, yeah. I mean, it would be wrong to just dismiss it for like that. Oh, it's just a crazy socialist plan. No. There is a real pedigree to this idea of a Green New Deal. And in fact, it's pretty much copied from an idea that's been circulating in certain circles for at least a decade, maybe a couple decades at this point, called the New Deal for Nature which is what they were calling it at the WWF, the World Wildlife Federation. No, that's the World Wrestling Federation. World Wildlife Foundation and other eugenicist-founded so-called conservancy groups like that have been talking about this New Deal for Nature for a while now, which, again, sounds nice to the woolly-eyed, I guess, socialists in the crowd who think, oh, the New Deal was a great thing that kept the country going during the Great Depression and until the World War II brought us out of the Depression, every single bit of which is wrong factually. But anyway, that's kind of what we're supposed to think when we hear New Deal. Oh, it's great. You know, this is a great government plan to fix everything. No, quite the opposite. As I point out in this article, what this is basically a blueprint for the financialization of nature, which is this concept where if the big corporations came out and said, we're just going to take over this vast tract of land and use it in any way we want, there would be public outrage about that. But if through these groups like the WWF and the Nature Conservancy and these other groups like this that are these NGOs and NPOs that all have on their boards the corporate interests and the eugenicists and all of this crazy stew of people who are stewarding over these organizations come along and in the name of nature, we're going to conserve and preserve this area. We're going to take over this area and make sure that it gets used for the right purposes, which of course is anything that they want once they get their blanket over it. And I know this sounds just crazy if you're just hearing it for the first time, but I did do a podcast on this called What is Sustainable Development? That's in the Corbett Report archives. I hope people would go and check that out if they're interested in this, because there's a lot of documentation to this, and this is part of a grander plan, as grand as that plan is, basically to monopolize the world and the world's resources under the name of conservation and green energy and all of these fancy, you know, green cloaks that they're putting on this agenda. But at base, this is the technocratic agenda. And what is technocracy? In a nutshell, it is a movement that actually there was a historical movement started in the 1930s, was quite popular at the time, largely forgotten today. The movement is largely forgotten today, but the ideology lives on. And the ideology was basically, we're going to have a team of scientists and engineers and statisticians and learned people who are going, they are the ones that should be ruling society, because we now have social sciences and economic sciences, and it's all scientific. You see, we can manage the economy, we can manage society itself, we just need to get the right managers in charge. And that's the technocratic dream. And how are they going to do this? They're going to create essentially a real-time operating network that databases, catalogs, analyzes everything flowing through the economy, all resources from natural resource to finished product, and everything along that supply chain, and then what happens to the product, and who consumes it, and what are the energy inputs and outputs and waste inputs and outputs are in every step of that process. How can you possibly do that? Back in the 1930s, that was a crazy dream. Well, now we're in the early 21st century, and we're talking about the Internet of Things and RFID and 5G and this smart grid and all of this that actually enables that dream to come to reality. And it's going to come in the name of saving the earth, saving nature. We're going to catalog every tree in every single forest in the United States and how big it is and where it's growing and all of this, and every blade of grass, I guess, eventually. And if you think I'm joking, nope. Microsoft unveiled their commercial during the Super Bowl about their AI for Nature program, and one of the grantees was this company that is literally going to do that. They're talking about cataloging every single tree in the forests of the United States. It sounds insanity. And it is, I suppose, but there's something very dark and insidious about this insanity, because it's being run by people who really do want to monopolize the resources and wealth of the world in the name of saving the earth. Of course they're going to wrap themselves in the cloak of green, because it's fashionable and trendy, and at least half of the population, the 50% or so that support the left side of the left-right bird of prey that is the government, are going to welcome it with open arms, because, oh, look, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the new Green Deal, it sounds good. I don't know what it's about, but let's just go with it.
But the thing is, what you just explained, there really is no way to stop it. I mean, you look at the amount of money that Microsoft has, the Zuckerbergs have, you look at the Bezos, there's so much money. They can do this. Their businesses there are created so they can do this. So what's to stop them?
And I think that's a good point, because it is such an overwhelming agenda. And the more you look into it, and the more, again, this might sound like crazy talk to people who have never looked into it, the more you look into the money that goes into these various organizations and foundations. I point to an excellent blog post in my article called From the Wrong Kind of Green blog, where they've been doing a multi-part series looking at the Green New Deal as the Trojan horse for the financialization of nature, and looking at the different organizations and how they're funded and who sits on their boards and where they get their money and all of this. It really is overwhelming, and it really does make you think, well, how do you stop an agenda like this that clearly has billions, if not trillions, of dollars, you know, behind it? And that is overwhelming. But I think there is an interesting part of all of this, which is that they do need to wrap themselves in this green cloak in order to get public approval to go along with this. Oh, they're doing it for the earth. Oh, it must be good. Let's go along with this. Let's not kick up a fuss. Don't look over here, guys. This isn't a political issue. You should all be talking about Jussie Smollett or whatever the news story of the week is. I think that indicates that our attention to stories like this and what is going on, and hey, wait, what is this group and what are they doing with this tract of land, and how did, wait, who gave them the right to do this cataloging of databasing, and wait, no, what's the 5G network again? The more that we involve ourselves in the real stories that are developing and that are part of this grid that's really being slotted into place here, then the more difficult it will be for them to get away with it. And hey, maybe they still can, but at any rate, we'll at least be looking in the right direction. My concern right now is that, yeah, exactly as Pelosi says, everyone's for the Green New Deal, just no one knows what it is. And that's the point. They just put a word over top of it, and no one even bothers to look underneath what does that word mean? What are we looking at here? And that's our downfall. So I think the first step is to at least understand what is happening and why it is happening. And then we can start to combat that. And it's not going to be easy. I'm not coming along pie in the sky, but I think we can at least infer that our opinions, our attention is important. And that's why they try to distract us with the cloak of green.
Yeah, but, you know, and it's true. I mean, it's going to be very difficult, because, you know, it is all about control. I mean, it is all about eventually, I guess what we've talked about, you're right, the new Green Deal and control, the nanny state, cradle to grave. It's what people have come to expect. And it's, they're like the Pied Piper. And, you know, people say, well, what's wrong? What's wrong with addressing our issues with emissions, and, you know, what's wrong with, you know, making things better and nicer, and, you know, for the future of our children and grandchildren? People don't have that critical thinking anymore, you know, and I don't know if the internet has provided great information for folks like you and me who do research, and for most, it's, they don't care to do it, they just follow. So I don't know, it's fascinating.
And it is overwhelming, which I think is what you're gesturing towards. There's so much information, and most people just want to tune out rather than tune in.
What we're going to have to do is tune into our breaks right now. We're heading into, we'll be right back right after a few short minutes. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey guy offers amazing specials for Berkey water filtration systems. The Berkey light systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey light system today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey light, the Berkey guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm joined today with James Corbett of The Corbett Report. Please make sure you check out the website, thecorbettreport.com, and look into James's interviews and his blogs that he does. A fantastic job. And we're going to talk about an interview that you recently had with a noted psychologist and author, Dr. Bruce Levine, to talk about his book, Resisting Illegitimate Authority. A Thinking Person's Guide to Being an Anti-Authoritarian. And so, in 50 words or less, more, tell the listeners about the interview, and in particular how dissent has been used by power structures and how those of us who oppose authoritarians can deal with oppressive power structures.
All right. Well, so I guess a definition or two might help to start with here. I mean, obviously, authority and illegitimate authority and anti-authoritarian being the key words here. So Dr. Bruce Levine, for people who don't know, is a practicing clinical psychologist, but he has definitely been, I think, something of a maverick in his field. And I was just going back and re-listening to a couple of my previous interviews with him, because I've interviewed him three times now. And in one of my previous interviews, he said something to the effect that psychiatry shouldn't exist, which is a pretty bold statement for someone in his field. But it reflects, I think, his position that ultimately the psychological profession has often been used as a tool or a weapon of oppressive power structures, basically to oppress people. And that's probably something that resonates with a lot of my audience, and I imagine a lot of your audience. And we can see this in a lot of different ways, and we talk about some of them in this interview, including some of the historical diagnoses that actually used to exist, like drapetomania, which is a word that probably not a lot of people know these days, but was diagnosed as a mental disorder, or at least some sort of physical disease, back 150 years ago, meaning, well, for a slave who attempted to escape slavery, well, why would they do that? I mean, it's such a great system. Why would they try to flee it? Well, there must be something wrong with them. So they must have something called drapetomania. And, you know, the cure for drapetomania is cutting off their toes or whatever once you capture them, once they, you know, they've tried to escape the plantation. So literally, escaping slaves had to be mentally ill, because why would they try to escape their enslavement? I mean, it's such a great system. So that's an example, just one example of many, of how psychology has been used to basically take anything dissenting of power structures or system that exists and saying it must be related to mental illness. And unfortunately, there's no lack of examples of that from our own time as well. The DSM-5, which is the latest diagnostic and statistical manual from the American Psychological Association, which is referred to as the diagnostic Bible for the psychiatric profession, includes oppositional defiant disorder. And I can't remember exactly when that was inserted into the DSM, maybe one or two editions ago. But oppositional defiant disorder is essentially to say that children who exhibit behavior like talking back to adults or not following orders or giving problems to authority figures like parents and teachers, even if, and actually this is specifically for not juvenile delinquents, not children that are actually breaking the law or injuring people or doing anything harmful in that sense, just children who are not dutifully following orders, can be diagnosed with this ODD, oppositional defiant disorder, and unfortunately medicated, because of course that's what we do in the modern system, is basically pump children full of psychotropic drugs and SSRIs and other mind-altering chemicals, because they didn't follow orders, they didn't sit still in their seat, they weren't good in school, or whatever the case may be. And that's, I mean, that is a truly horrific and really disturbing subject when you look at it, and look at the rates of medication of even children in the United States, and how that's gone up in the last few decades. And one of the things that we talk about in the interview is the startling, I think it should be startling to a lot of people in the crowd, because if I was just consuming my news from the mainstream media sources, I would probably still believe what was being propounded. At least I can remember back when I was in high school or a young adult in university. I remember at the time that everyone basically believed that, well, mental illness is due to some sort of chemical imbalance, usually, that there's some sort of chemical imbalance. And so if you're depressed, for example, you take an SSRI and it will do something to your serotonin or whatever. I don't know the details, but it'll make you better. And that was propounded at that time quite heavily. But as people may or may not know, that it has been utterly dismissed by the psychiatric profession in recent years, to the point where back in 2011, a prominent doctor, Ronald Pies, P-I-E-S, wrote an article in Psychiatric Times saying that that was an urban legend that was never taken seriously by well-informed psychiatrists. Well, news to me, that's certainly the way that the SSRIs, Prozac, and all of that was being pumped back in the 90s and early part of this century, that's always the way it was introduced. There's a chemical imbalance, and this will balance you out. So there's clearly, and the APA, of course, the American Psychiatric Association, does receive some part of its funding, a substantial part of its funding, from Big Pharma. Surprise, surprise. There is an insidious relationship there. So there's, I think, a mutually beneficial for them power structure that exists for governments and other authoritarian outlets, and the pharmaceutical companies and the psychiatric profession that work in tandem to make sure that people who have a problem with illegitimate authority, and how do you define that? I suppose that's a tricky thing to define, but illegitimate authority, people who dissent against power structures, well, they have to be dealt with one way or another, and a convenient way of doing it is pathologizing them, basically saying they must be insane because we live in such a great society. How could you possibly be unhappy with the way things are?
So they're using the children as examples? And why is the U.S. the only country? You don't have the same problems in Japan. You don't have the same issues even in Europe, where all of these children are on, you know, some sort of a drug, SSRI and so forth. Why are they being the guinea pigs? Or right. Why is the United States the leading? And no
it
one
often
does anything.
Is, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, this is the thing. I don't have the statistics in front of me, so I can't say this with any authority in terms of the actual statistics and figures. But I can say from my experience here in Japan and having worked in the Japanese school system that, yes, the idea of medicating children because they won't sit still in class or whatever was just, it's ludicrous. I mean, yeah. It's not even suggested. So there is a substantial difference, at least from here to the United States. And I don't know. I don't know if we can put all of this down to this, but as with so many other things, the King Dollar is the ruler of the country, and there are powerful lobby interests in the pharmaceutical industry that do absolutely influence lawmakers there in the United States, congressmen, as we know from a lot of different angles. One, of course, that I assume a lot of your listeners will know about is vaccines and vaccine manufacturers and how they get special immunity from prosecution from people who get sick because of the vaccines that are taken. So that is, unfortunately, it's a system that exists in the United States in a fashion that it doesn't necessarily exist in other countries. And I think it is kind of a guinea pig situation. Anything that's rolled out, any authoritarian idea like this that's rolled out in any one country is coming to your country soon enough. Once the idea is introduced. As an example, going the other way, there's more There's just a fresh report in the news today about China's social credit system, showing that their annual blacklist of, you know, every year they revise their blacklist of people who can't take flights or get on high-speed trains or whatever. They've just added 3.59 million new Chinese people to that list over in 2019. So now another few million people in China won't be able to do basic things like flying on an airplane because they're bad citizens. Well, as we know, that idea is coming to the U.S. and Japan and everywhere else soon enough. And perhaps it already exists to some extent here, but they're going to roll that out here. And in the same way, the type of let's medicate everyone may start in the United States, but I think the ultimate plan for the pharmaceutical companies anyway would be to roll that out around the world.
Right. Because the U.S. is running out of money, I guess, maybe. I don't know. I get the money, I get the lobbyists, I get all that, but yet there's no one that actually stands up and says...
Well, there are. There are. And people like Bruce Levine, and as he points out in the interview, when the psychologists and psychiatrists, the sort of big wigs of the profession started coming out about 8 or 9 years ago to say, you know, that chemical imbalance thing, that was all an urban legend and we never believed it. They actually blamed the propagation of that idea on people like Bruce Levine for speaking out against it, for saying, no, this isn't a chemical imbalance and you know that's not true. And they said, no, we never said there was a chemical imbalance. That's you and people like you were spreading that idea. Yeah. Where, of course it isn't. I know that. Because, again, as I say, I remember the propaganda that was floating around a couple decades ago about how it's a chemical imbalance, so you need drugs to make it better. And I think everyone knows that. And, of course, when you look back at their advertising and everything that they did, they always accompanied it with the weasel words about, you know, it may be the result of a chemical imbalance or whatever. But that's, of course, not the message that people hear when they're seeing the commercials. They take the idea, oh, it's a chemical imbalance. And it's like... I'm a diabetic, I need insulin. I'm a depressive, I need Prozac. I mean, that was the way it was sold to the public. And unfortunately, it was an exceptionally powerful and effective advertising campaign.
We're going to move on. We're going to talk a little bit about North Korea. There's a second summit a week away. President Trump is going to give Kim Jong-un something he desperately wanted, and that was an announcement of a formal end to the 1950s Korean War. But I also read this week, too, that President Trump had said he's not expecting them to denuclearize. So how do you think this is all going to, you know, certainly Washington still wants the removal and destruction of these stockpiles of these weapons and so forth, but yet President Trump just came out and said, "As long as you're not testing those missiles, I'm okay with it." How do you think that's all going to go over in Vietnam when he's over there?
Well, I think at this point, what we're seeing is the political face saving, because of course the moon was promised, and when the moon can't be delivered, then the politicians will give you whatever they can. And I think that's essentially what happened here. They're going to denuclearize and everything's better and the war's over and everyone will live happily ever after. They've still got nukes. Well, whatever. I mean, at least we're not at war anymore. We never really were at war, were we? But, or, you know, technically at war, but, you know, the nukes weren't exactly flying, but, you know, it makes us feel like something has really profoundly changed, doesn't it? I mean, everyone would say, oh yeah, relations are so much better now than they were a year or two ago, but why were relations so bad a year or two ago, and why are they so good now? There's not really a good answer for that, other than, well, we decided that we don't want to be exchanging threats anymore. So it's all kind of a political charade in a way, and now they're just going to take away the focus from this and say, hey, look, it's a win. And so any way that they can put this in the win column, I think they'll try to do that. What has actually substantially really changed? I think if there's any actual difference and anything that's actually promising from all this, it's the thawing of relations between South and North Korea, and the fact that they're talking to each other and having conferences now, that is a good thing. And ultimately, as I've always said, if real peace, not just peace on paper or whatever, if actual progress is going to happen, it's going to be between South and North Korea. And the U.S. and China and everyone else wants to have their finger in that pie. But if the Korean people aren't talking to each other, that's going to be the main thing. So if nothing else, at the very least, South and North Korea are more cooperating more closely these days, and that's at least to the good. I mean, hey, let's put it this way, at least it isn't. It hasn't devolved into some sort of invasion or warfare scenario, as looked like it could happen a year or two ago.
Absolutely. And with China, the trade talks, I read where the U.S. is asking China to stabilize the value of their currency as part of trade deliberations that continue between our country, the U.S., and China. And do you think, again, this is, how do you think those talks are going to, the Chinese, China's Vice Premier Liu, he's in Washington for more talks. And is this going to be more just a good ending so everyone... Or do you really think that something's going to come from these trade talks between China and the U.S.?
I'm not particularly hopeful. But there may be some sort of agreement reached in the near term, but I think the longer-term pressures are still there. And the idea of the U.S. and Chinese economies as kind of competitors, but also friends, a frenemy-type situation, that fundamental paradox still remains. And I don't think that's going to be resolved by any agreement or handshake. So there's some deeper structural issues here, and I don't think that's going to be solved in the next week or two.
All right. We're just about out of time. We've got about a minute and a half. Is there anything that we didn't touch on this evening that you would like to share with the listeners, James?
Well, I would just ask them to stay tuned to CorbettReport.com. Last time I was on, we were talking about science and the crisis of science.
Yes.
Well, my podcast on that topic is about to drop, hopefully in the next 24 hours or so. That's the plan anyway. We'll see if it gets out on time. But in the near future, that podcast will be coming out so people can get more details on that. And that will actually be the first part of a two-part podcast series that I'm going to do. And the second part will be about solutions to the crisis of science, which I think is even more important than identifying the crisis itself.
And anything else?
And it's for the forecaster, I haven't decided yet, but I'm probably going to be writing about the International Criminal Court and some of the recent news surrounding that. So an interesting topic.
Well, thank you so much, James. We always appreciate you being here. And I want to thank the listeners for tuning in. Also, don't forget to call Discount Gold and Silver, 1-800-375-4188. Dave Allen and I will be returning on Monday. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
Have a plan. If I got me a wealthy man.